The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, friends. This is Larry Wilson for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Money Matters. Today's program is supported by Coastal Credit Union Foundation. For more information on the Coastal Credit Union Foundation, you can find it at coastal24.com/foundation. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you articles of interest from a new publication we have called Frugal Living, and also a couple of articles that appeared in Kiplinger Personal Finance. Our first article up from Frugal Living is an interesting article for those of us, some who maybe cook at home and some who don't, but it's certainly good advice, and that's on meal planning. Six easy secrets to success. If your budget is tight, it doesn't mean that you need more rules. Being low on cash is already restrictive enough. What you do need is fewer decisions. Meal planning helps me simplify my grocery budget and slash it by making sure I have what I need, use what I buy, and avoid wandering grocery aisles without a plan. It also keeps me from dialing 1-800-PIZZA or veering into the nearest fast food drive-thru on a busy day because I have no idea what we're going to eat. If your goal is to spend less on groceries, waste less food, and still get a healthy home-cooked meal on the table every night, meal planning doesn't just mean choosing five delicious-sounding dinners from your Pinterest board, writing down all the ingredients, and heading to the store. That approach works when money is plentiful. But when it isn't, it's a recipe for overspending and wasted food. Read on, and let me show you how I plan meals for my family when there's nary a dime to spare. What's on hand? Before I plan a single meal, I take a quick inventory of what I already have. This step alone can lighten your grocery list because every ingredient you use is one you don't have to buy and also one that won't go to waste. I start with the fridge. Is there anything that's meaningful and nearing the end of its useful life? Vegetables that are about to wilt, ground chicken that needs to be cooked or frozen, dairy products creeping towards their expiration dates. I write these down first because they've just become the building blocks for the earliest meals of the week. Next, I move on to longer-term storage and check on the stuff in my freezer and pantry. Maybe there's a forgotten roast tucked in the freezer, or plenty of rice and pasta already on the shelves. These ingredients don't have to be used, but when I can work them into the plan, that's less money I'll be spending at the store. And what's on sale? Once I know what I already have, then I look at what's on sale. Grocery flyers may not pile up in the mailbox anymore, but the information is still there. It's just gone digital. Instead of visiting each store in person to hunt for deals, I head straight to their websites and browse the weekly flyers online. It's the same process as before, minus the paper and pen. I jot down the deals at each store that genuinely fit into my plan. That last part matters. Sometimes it makes sense to shop at more than one store, and sometimes it doesn't. I always make sure the money I'd saved by hitting multiple stores is greater than the money I spend on spending gas getting there. Don't forget, your time is valuable too. What's the schedule? This is where traditional meal planning goes to die. Your plan has to take your real schedule into account, not an ideal one you've dreamed up that's never going to happen. When my kids were young, I needed a calendar to keep straight all the after-school activities and lessons, late work meetings, evening commitments, and standing weekly events. All of it matters, and all of it needs a realistic plan. If you ignore what your schedule really looks like, you're setting yourself up for last-minute decisions. My last-minute decisions almost always cost more. It's at the last minute when takeout starts looking like the easiest option. For busy nights, I plan differently. Some nights, I make a slow cooker meal that's ready the moment we walk into the door. Other nights, I intentionally plan for leftovers that can be reheated quickly. Sometimes dinner is as simple as sandwiches or wraps we can eat on the go. With a little forethought, even the busiest nights can run smoothly, and the budget stays intact. Make a plan. You've gathered all the important information. You know what you have on hand, and you've taken your schedule into account so that you have a clear picture of the week ahead. Now it's time to decide what you're actually going to eat this week. Start by using up the items that are on their last legs in the first few meals. For example, if I have ground chicken that needs to be cooked and broccoli that's starting to wilt, I might plan a simple stir fry served over rice from the pantry. Sweet and spicy ground beef or chicken, anyone? If I feel like changing it up, I could grab a head of leaf lettuce and turn those same ingredients into Korean-style lettuce wraps with the steamed broccoli on the side. Leftovers are fair game, too. A bit of leftover roast beef can easily become burritos with tortillas from the store and refried beans already in the pantry. When you think in terms of ingredients instead of recipes, it's surprisingly easy to come up with meals that are affordable and flexible and still feel like something the whole family will look forward to. Add some shopping as needed. Once I have a rough framework in place, I layer in what's on sale that week. Often I start with the protein and build meals around it. Whole chickens, ham, ground beef, whatever the best deal is that becomes the anchor for a few meals. From there, I look for ways to pair these sale items with ingredients I already have. Ground beef, for example, can be combined with canned tomato puree and spices to make a hearty spaghetti sauce served over pasta from the pantry. You might want to add a few vegetables to your list, like bell peppers or mushrooms, but the base of the meal is already covered. A ham could be paired with scalloped potatoes from a box you already have on hand, or, if time allows, made from scratch. Any leftovers can be stretched even further. That same ham can easily become the base for a pot of soup using split peas or other pantry staples. When you think this way, sales stop being distractions and start becoming opportunities. You're not buying something just because it's cheap. You're buying it because it fits into a plan you've already built. And set the schedule. The last step in making sure your plan works with the week you've actually already that you have ahead of you is to look at what's coming up. Is there a birthday on the calendar? Make sure you have the ingredients for a favorite meal, or if going out is your tradition, pencil that in now so it doesn't throw off the rest of the plan. Think about nights when everyone is heading in different directions. Those are perfect candidates for simple car meals like sandwiches with veggie sticks that can be eaten on the go. If you know you'll be getting home late one evening, that might be the ideal night for a slow cooker meal that's ready to serve as soon as you arrive home. Planning this way doesn't just save money. It takes a tremendous amount of stress off your shoulders and makes the week run more smoothly for everyone. Meal planning shouldn't be rigid or complicated to be helpful. When you start with what you already have, pay attention to what's on sale and plan around your real schedule. It becomes a quiet way to care for your family and yourself. With a little planning, even a tight grocery budget can stretch further, and dinner can feel less like a problem to solve and more like a familiar, comforting part of the day. Well, that's certainly good words of advice for all of us. Our next article appeared in Kiplinger Personal Finance. This article is written by Cameron Huddleston, and it was conducted with an interview with Beth Pinksker, who is a certified financial planner, Market Watch columnist, and author of My Mother's Money, A Guide to Financial Caregiving. And the article is titled, Managing Money for a Loved One Who Can't. Becoming a financial caregiver for an aging or ill relative will go more smoothly if you plan for the possibility in advance. And the first question posed to Ms. Pinksker, your new book is about becoming a financial caregiver for your mother after she grew seriously ill due to complications from spinal surgery. What is financial caregiving? Financial caregiving is when you step into somebody else's shoes and take over their affairs. Most people are dragged into this role sideways and have no idea how the person they're helping has been handling money. When I started helping my mom, I knew nothing about how she had been running her household, and she wasn't in a position to tell me anything after her back surgery. To keep the mortgage paid and the lights on, I had to figure out how she had been paying her bills by sorting through the papers on her desk. Question: what are the most important steps people should take to prepare for the possibility of becoming a financial caregiver? You need to make sure the person you're going to take care of has two key documents: a durable power of attorney that legally allows you to make financial decisions on their behalf, and, if you're also going to be making medical decisions, a health care proxy. And make sure you have access to those documents. If you can't put your hands on them, you're going to be stuck and might end up in court. For financial matters, a lot of people think it's enough to be a joint owner on an account with an aging parent. But that can be problematic. There may be one account that you're a joint signer on, but the other accounts you need access to, such as brokerage accounts, credit cards, and that sort of thing, you'll probably need a power of attorney for the cable company, the electric company, the lawn care company. You never know when someone's going to say they need power of attorney in order to process whatever it is that you want to process. Question: what if the tables are turned? How can people prepare their loved ones to step into the roles of financial caregiver for them? Put together what I call a cheat sheet and a death file. My mom did this for me. The cheat sheet lists all of the person's medicines and their doses, surgical history, key doctors, their social security numbers. The death file is everything you need if something happens to them, like their will or trust, a list of their accounts, birth certificate, life insurance contract, and cemetery plot information. Question: what's the hardest thing about managing someone else's money? The hardest part for me was trying to maintain my mom's very precise financial routine. My mom was always very particular about her finances and a little old-fashioned. She didn't trust electronic banking. It was all paper statements and paper checks. I was managing her finances from 1,000 miles away, and I had to take care of things electronically. I always thought she was going to be mad at me. I was afraid the whole time I wasn't living up to her standards. My general advice is to keep people in the loop. The person you're taking care of or a sibling is going to want some accounting. I kept a spreadsheet of money coming in and going out of my mom's accounts and things I paid out of my own pocket that I then reimbursed myself for. And lastly, the last question, what is one thing you wish your mom had done to better prepare you? I wish we had talked more openly in the years before she got sick, because there were a lot of things that didn't occur to us to talk about once we were in an emergency mode. These were small things, like asking about certain missing pieces of jewelry, but still important. The one that haunts me is that I think she had a storage locker in the basement of her apartment building that my grandmother's paintings were in, and I couldn't find any record of it after my mom died. Maybe someday the building will call me and say they found it. And here's an interesting article that appeared in Kiplinger Personal Finance. Advice for Handling an Inheritance. Money Smart Women by Janet Bodner. Lately, I've been getting a lot of news releases about what's being called the Great Wealth Transfer. Upwards of $124 trillion that could change hands between generations over the next 10 to 20 years. And much of that inheritance will likely end up in the hands of women, wives, daughters, siblings, granddaughters, if for no other reason than women tend to outlive men. But before you count on that cash, a word of caution is in order. I've been hearing about a generational windfall for the last 30 years, and I haven't seen it materialize, says Alexandra Armstrong, a certified financial planner and author of On Your Own, A Widow's Guide to Emotional and Financial Well-Being. She has worked with clients who counted on inheriting from their parents, only to find out that their parents didn't die anytime soon, and there wasn't that much left anyways. What gives me pause is the combination of longer lifespans and the cost of medical care, says Elizabeth Zielinki Parsons, a lawyer and author of Encore, A High Achiever's Guide to Thriving in Retirement. I certainly would not suggest that clients build an inheritance into their financial plan. At the other end of the spectrum, 30% of people who inherit money have basically spent their inheritance within a year, says Natalie Coley, partner and senior lead advisor at Francis Financial in New York City. For people over age 50, that jumps to 40%. One problem, she says, is that people often receive an inheritance at, quote, possibly the worst time of their lives. Not only are you likely to be grieving the loss of a family member, but you might also have feelings of guilt or resentment and be faced with managing your new financial situation. Avoidance is a common reaction, says Coley. On top of that, navigating the legalities of taking possession of an inheritance can be daunting. Even people who are savvy with financial matters have trouble with this, says Parsons. Inheriting is a lot of work. Well, where to start? To make the process as smooth as possible, Parson gives her clients a roadmap. For the first 30 days, she says, just catch your breath and use that time to get all of your documents in order. For example, you would need copies of any will, trust, or estate plan that exist, as well as any account statements for all assets, plus any insurance policies, loan documents, and real estate deeds. And get at least 6 copies of the death certificate. You need to come up with an inventory of everything you have received and the value of those assets, which will determine whether the estate or trust has a tax liability. Your lawyer should be able to help you, and you also might want to consult a certified public accountant or other tax professional or a financial advisor. If you have a clear picture of your inheritance after 60 days, you're in good shape, says Parsons. One issue you might face is getting access to certain assets. For example, if your husband had a bank account in his name with no joint ownership or pay-on-death provision, you might need a court order to access it. Depending on what you've inherited, you may also be responsible for certain ongoing activities. With real estate, for instance, you may have to make mortgage or tax payments or create a maintenance checklist. Any planning you can do in advance, say between two spouses or between parents and adult children, can make the whole process go more smoothly. Sit down once or twice a year with your spouse to go over your accounts and how to get into them, says Parsons. Become as literate as you can before there's a compelling need. Well, that is certainly, again, good advice for us as we approach those years and to try to be prepared. Our next article actually appeared in the AARP Bulletin. Under the Money Saver category, five ways to slash your medical bills. Keep more money in your pocket without sacrificing the quality of your health care. This article by David Hodgman. Ask for your no-cost exams and vaccines. Original Medicare and most Medicare Advantage plans offer a wide range of free preventive services, such as annual wellness visits, mammograms, colonoscopies, bone density scans, and recommended vaccines like those for the flu and pneumonia. Taking advantage of them gives you a chance to catch silent problems early when treatment can be more simple and much less expensive. Yet millions leave these benefits on the table. In 2022, about 40% of eligible policyholders failed to take advantage of their free wellness visits. And look for deals on drugs. Check all the coupon sites, says journalist Dan Weissman, creator of the healthcare podcast An Arm and a Leg. Companies including GoodRx, ScriptSave, WellRx, and OptumRx, that's the supplier of the AARP prescription discounts provided by OptumRx program, offer steep discounts off retail prices for select drugs at participating pharmacies. Warehouse Clubs, Costco, and Sam's Club discount heavily, too. Sam's Club Plus members can receive a certain generic medication, can receive certain generic medications for 30 days at no cost, and more than 600 generics for $10 or less. Savings at Costco can be up to 80%. Avoid hospitals for routine scans. A 2020 United Health Group report found that hospital outpatient imaging cost an eye-popping 165% more on average than the same scan at a standalone center. If your doctor orders a routine MRI scan, CT scan, or echocardiogram, consider getting it done at an independent imaging clinic. Just make sure that the imaging center is covered by your insurance. And be curious about treatment. Up to 30% of prescribed medical services provide little or no value, according to a study published by the American Board of Internal Medicine's ABIM Foundation. Here are some useful questions you might ask a provider before you take a medication or opt for a test, surgery, or other procedure. Why do I need this? What happens if I don't do it? Are there side effects? And are there lower cost options? And lastly, get free help with bills and denials. If you're battling a serious medical condition, the nonprofit Patient Advocate Foundation may be able to provide a case manager to help you fight billing errors, appeal insurance denials, negotiate payment options, and qualify for financial support. The group says that in 2024, it provided assistance to more than 193,000 patients and distributed over $335 million in financial support. You can visit patientadvocate.org or call 800-532-5274 to connect with a case manager and learn whether you meet eligibility requirements. And as we wrap up our program and episode today, here are a couple of money saver ideas. An ounce of prevention. Avoid the cost of replacing your big ticket possessions by following these simple tips for keeping them in good working order. And appliances. Reading the manual always helps to keep household appliances in good shape. You can usually download one of the manufacturers off the website if you've lost your manual. And cleaning is another good idea because accumulated dust strains a refrigerator's cooling system, for example. It is recommended that vacuuming the coals every 6 to 12 months, more often if you're a pet owner, will help that. And if you've ever removed an old refrigerator, you know how gross the coals can get. And your mattress. The standard advice is to flip and rotate your mattress. But what do you do with the modern unflippable pillow top? Rotating your mattress 180 degrees every 3 to 6 months is still the best thing you can do, says Joel Breen, owner of JB's Furniture in Milwaukee. Breen also suggests vacuuming your mattress regularly. We have dead skin and other stuff that comes off us at night, he says. Vacuuming that away can help keep your mattress feeling newer. And your water heater. Over time, sediment settles at the bottom of a traditional storage tank, water tank, which means the heating element has to work harder, says Tim Beachy, project manager for Nicholson Builders in Columbus, Ohio. The easy fix is to flush the tank at least once a year. You can find many how-to videos online how to do that, but few people do, Beachy says. That's partially because the drain valve can be small and tough to reach, he says. Replace it with a brass ball valve that's easier to use, and you're more likely to flush the tank on schedule. That sounds like one you may want to call a handyman to help you with. Well, we are now out of time for today's episode of Money Matters. Thank you for joining us, and we hope you will join us again next time. This is Larry Wilson on behalf of the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's episode of Money Matters is supported by Coastal Credit Union Foundation. For more information on the Coastal Credit Union Foundation, you can find it at coastal24.com/foundation. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Money Matters is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. The number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.